Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
This project really is aimed at restoring fish passage across roads and motorized trails, which are fragmenting fish habitat.
The Forest Service seeks to reverse logging damage in Southeast Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 10th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, younger, smaller king salmon are returning to the Kuskokwim River.
There's not a silver bullet yet on what is causing this, but it's not a phenomenon that's just local to the Kuskokwim.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Alaska State Troopers say that a missing woman from the Yukon River village of Marshall has been found dead. Kimberly Fitka O'Domin's body was found by a couple not involved with the search about 30 miles upriver from Emonic on June 27th, but she wasn't publicly identified until July 6th. Alaska State Troopers, citing the state medical examiner's office, say she drowned. O'Domin's family and friends had been searching for her since she went missing from the village in mid-June. According to a trooper report, they don't have any evidence of foul play, but will continue to investigate the circumstances of her death. O'Domin's family has since set up a GoFundMe account to help cover cost of living expenses for her 7 surviving children. A former Minto Village Council bookkeeper has been sentenced for embezzlement. According to a written statement from the Alaska U.S. Attorney's Office, 52-year-old Melanie Gail Titus pleaded guilty last winter to felony theft related to tribal programs, which receive federal funds. It says, beginning in 2015, Titus issued herself multiple payroll checks for the same pay periods, tendered duplicative deposits, and falsified reimbursements for work expenses. Titus confessed to the village council in 2019, triggering a federal investigation that found she'd stolen over $55,000. Under a sentence handed down by U.S. Chief District Judge Sharon L. Gleason, Titus must pay back the money she stole, perform 300 hours of community service to benefit the village council, and remain on probation for 5 years. A study from University of Alaska researchers has found that Alaska school districts that are remote and serve mainly students from low-income households need to pay substantially more than they currently do to attract and retain teachers. The Alaska Beacon reports that Matthew Berman, a University of Alaska Anchorage economics professor, said that the study shows compensation does matter when it comes to recruitment and retention, and that some districts can and do pay teachers more to offset other disadvantages like a remote location. The study uses data from a contract the university had with the state's education department during the administration of former Governor Bill Walker. Berman said the researchers are currently taking a look at more recent data and finding similar but magnified results after the pandemic. The results of the study showed that compensation rates were adequate to hire and keep teachers in the state's urban and suburban school districts, but to have equity in many rural communities, districts would need to pay substantially more. Study results said that 1 in 5 of the state's schools would need to pay teachers 25 to 50% more to hire and keep them, especially in the western and northern parts of the state. Berman said a barrier to increasing teacher wages in rural districts is that basic operating costs can be significantly higher than in other areas. Nearly 700 sites along Tongass National Forest streams could obstruct fish from migrating. That's according to a new report from the U.S. Forest Service. As Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, there is a plan to deal with the old roads and culverts causing the problems.
Restoring forest land from old logging projects has been a tough lesson to learn. Back in the 50s and 60s, timber was harvested throughout Southeast Alaska without plans for how all the construction, like roads, culverts, and bridges, would affect fish habitats as they deteriorate in the years to come. And that deterioration has proved to be a big problem for fish.
Fish migrate, so we need to ensure that they have that opportunity.
Sheila Jacobson is a fisheries program manager for the U.S. Forest Service. She is leading a new project that seeks to restore all 700 of the crossings on the Tongass that aren't up to the current federal standards. She says migrating fish, including salmon, steelhead, and trout, swim into human-caused barriers left over from those days of heavy logging.
This project really is aimed at restoring fish passage across roads and motorized trails, which are fragmenting fish habitat across the entire forest.
The federal agency has been documenting these stream crossings since the early 1990s. The Forest Service has tried to restore them one by one as funding allows. Now, they've compiled all of them into one project, the Tongass National Forest Fish Passage Restoration, which can be added to as more crossings are identified. Jacobson says it should make for a more streamlined process.
This sets us up well for being able to capitalize on some of the new funding streams that have been coming up in the past year or so. And then partners are able to help us with grant opportunities as well. So we are definitely being able to get more project funding for this particular issue.
The Forest Service isn't the only one restoring streams on the Tongass. The agency has several partnerships, including the Huna Native Forest Partnership. Ian Johnson runs the Environmental Department for the tribe, Huna Indian Association. For the past 5 years, they've run programs that have local workers restoring watersheds in the area. Huna is on the northeast side of Chichikov Island. Johnson says streams there have been affected by past logging.
When fish aren't passing through a culvert, you know, if there's a meter perch or something on the backside, people can see that.
Johnson says around 6 years ago, the tribe surveyed the community about environmental issues, and stream restoration was ranked number one. He says some community members had worked for the logging industry in the past.
There were a lot of folks here who were a part of the logging and, you know, experienced the logging, and those that had concern at the time about the effect of logging right up to the stream edge.
Now, workers with Huna Native Forest Partnership fix culverts and bridges and reintroduce wood into watersheds that lost that natural process through logging. Johnson says healthy streams are important, especially for communities that rely on the land around them.
Huna, as a community that relies on subsistence resources, meet many of its needs, especially around protein, need to have a landscape that can provide those resources.
The Forest Service wants to grow partnerships like the one with Huna. Fixing 700 stream crossings is a lot. It's a plan that spans nearly the whole southeast region, except for Prince of Wales Island. That island has 2,000 miles of mostly logging roads and has its own restoration plan. Many of the bad logging practices started changing in 1976 with the passage of the National Forest Management Act. It regulated the timber industry, limiting the size of clearcuts and how far away from streams they could be. Reporting for Coast Alaska in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, cyclists in Anchorage ride to advocate for better bike lane access.
It is perfectly legal for bikes to ride in the road, but there are a lot of really aggressive motorists.
That is ahead in the road. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Quality childcare creates futures for families, children, and the state's economy. When children are safe, engaged, and learning, parents can work and everyone has a better outcome. Thread has resources to support your family in their childcare search. Knowing what to look for in a licensed facility is important for the safety of your children. Thread also offers parenting resources and support. To learn more about quality childcare in Alaska, visit threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by Thread.
White Pass and Yukon Route rail workers voted last week to authorize a strike. The railway is Skagway's biggest employer and one of the most popular tourist attractions in Southeast Alaska. A strike will not happen right away, though. Negotiations are bound by the Railway Labor Act, which requires mediation and a 30-day cooling-off period before workers could strike. Jason Geiler chairs the local chapter of the union that represents White Pass's 27 Alaska-based engineers, conductors, and brakemen. He said the vote was overwhelmingly supported by union members.
I think that many of the group feel that it's unfortunate that at this point the company has yet to come forward with a recognition of the wages that we do deserve.
In a press release, Union Vice President Brent Leonard said the railroad's pay has not kept up with the cost of living. Leonard said, quote, 6 years is far too long for these families to go without normal raises, end quote. Geiler says union members want to keep working, but they also want recognition for the work they do.
It's an opportunity to be able to participate in these once-in-a-lifetime opportunities and experiences with these guests who come to visit Skagway and here in Alaska.
As of this morning, representatives of the railroad had not responded to a request for an interview. Petersburg's Catholic Church caught fire Thursday afternoon in a blaze that continued for nearly 10 hours. KFSK's Thomas Copeland has the story.
Don Koenigs has attended St. Catherine's of Siena Catholic Church for over 40 years. He was one of just two parishioners at midday mass on Thursday.
I saw smoke while I was inside from the skylight in the church. We were just ready to receive Holy Communion. I looked up and I saw smoke billowing up above. So I ran out of the church immediately and could see that the church was on fire. I ran in and told Father, we were called 911, and I said, you have to take Jesus out of the tabernacle.
At 12:29 p.m., emergency dispatch received multiple calls as neighbors and passersby caught sight of the flames. Fire, EMS, search and rescue, and law enforcement were all on the scene within minutes. As the firefighters tackled the blaze, smoke billowed from St. Catherine's down into Petersburg. At Petersburg Medical Center, CEO Phil Hofstetter saw the smoke as it blew down the hill to the clinic.
It was almost like it was porous. It went right through the building.
And that meant scores of appointments were quickly canceled.
Well, we closed all our non-essential services right now, and we sent staff home. We put in some air scrubbers into the different units for long-term care.
Back at St. Catherine's, crowds gathered as the church roof began to cave in, and its spire buckled under the heat of the flames.
Bringing tears to my eyes earlier.
I've never seen anything like this. Lived here 48 years.
It's going to be tough on all the parishioners there and stuff. They're going to need a lot of community support.
Among the onlookers stood Father Jose. This is his first year at St. Catherine's.
So heartbreaking. So heartbreaking. But we will survive, you know, that's our hope. And I want to thank all the fire department works. They are working hard to control this fire.
As the first hour rolled on, more volunteers arrived on the scene. Some, like Taylor Norheim, even raced in from the water to fight the fire.
I got here late even. I was out on the boat. I had to go cancel work for the day because if I didn't do it and nobody was doing it, somebody's got to do it.
The Petersburg Fire Department has to rely on volunteers, many with full-time jobs like Norheim. And Fire Department spokesperson Dave Berg said that means when a massive blaze like this occurs, the worst he's seen in a quarter century, they can find themselves with just a skeleton crew.
We showed up with three engines. One engine came in with only a driver. It's capable of carrying a crew of six. And another engine came in short-staffed also.
Do you think you could have saved more of the church if you had more volunteers?
Oh, I think so, yeah. Our volunteer staff has been declining over the years. There's just, people don't seem to be as interested in either fire service or volunteering as a whole.
And Aaron Hankins, the director of fire and EMS, said in a race against time, fewer volunteers can have a massive impact.
Would you have done this operation differently if you'd had more volunteers, Aaron?
We might have been able to get up on the roof before the entire thing was compromised, but by the time we got access and had enough volunteers to do it, it was kind of not really safe to go on there.
As the afternoon turned to evening, the flames died down, but refused to die out. 4-inch thick wooden beams, tightly layered on the roof of the sanctuary, blocked the hoses from extinguishing the flames smouldering underneath. And the attic of the fellowship was just as hard to reach. And so the chainsaws came out to carve up chunks of timber to allow for a way for the water to get in.
So I think for this week...
Across a car park in the Parks and Rec Gymnasium, the St. Catherine's congregation gathered for communion, prayer, and to plan for the days ahead. Father Jose was living at the back of the church before it burned down, and in a brief moment of levity, he told the parishioners he just brought home some groceries.
I was about to cook today. I just brought some pork, and I served enough for it. I think, you know, maybe roasted now with the fire.
The congregation hopes to assemble for Mass this weekend in the grotto next to the burnt-out church, but they don't yet know what can be salvaged from inside. As the parishioners left the gymnasium, they stopped to watch the firefighters still battling the stubborn flames burning in the church roof. It was past 10 p.m. when the final hose was turned off. Just one injury among the multi-agency army of Petersburg volunteers, a broken finger in the fire crew. The cause of the blaze will be investigated in the days and weeks to come by local and state fire marshals. But for now, St. Catherine's of Siena is reduced to a shell. In Petersburg, I'm Thomas Copeland.
In weekly meetings of the long-standing Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group, state and federal fisheries managers, tribal representatives, and a wide range of voices come together to paint a picture combining biological data and firsthand accounts from people who live on the Kuskokwim. Amid crashing salmon runs, the group is a sounding board for the challenges being seen along the river. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, one hot topic right now is that it's not just salmon runs that are getting smaller, but some of the Chinook salmon that do return are becoming smaller as well.
During last Wednesday's meeting of the Kuskokwim River Working Group, Bethel Elder Robert Hoffman said he was frustrated about the type of fishing gear being permitted.
Yes, we have met our fish goals, reds, chums, and jack salmon, but we have not reached our king salmon, what we used to call king salmon a long time ago, due to the fact that we only use 6-inch.
Hoffman is referring to the maximum mesh size of the gill nets that federally qualified subsistence users are allowed to use during the limited number of openings on the river. The nets are far less likely to catch large egg-bearing female Chinook salmon on the last leg of their journey up the river. But they are great for catching smaller kings.
We're trying to put as many of those big fish through the fishery and harvest more of the abundant, smaller, predominantly male fish.
That's Nick Smith, a management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He says there have been fewer Chinook salmon returning to the river, and the runs are changing.
Males are getting younger at the age they come back, and then so are the females. So what traditionally was a 6-year-old female making up a lot of the run is now 5-year-old females.
According to Smith, half of the Chinook salmon that returned to the Kuskokwim River in 2022 were even younger, age 4. Males that are age 4 or younger are known in Alaska as jacks. Hoffman says he's been seeing a lot of them.
Only catching what they call them jacks, jack salmon.
While the juvenile Chinook that leave Alaska's rivers are known for spending years at sea packing on the pounds, a sizable percentage returns far earlier. The jacks are sexually mature but small. Smith says the typical jack spends 1 to 3 years at sea. Among the many jacks swimming up the Kuskokwim River, there are even a tiny percentage of what are known as gills, small female Chinook that also return home early.
Yep, I've seen gill kings before.
Upon reaching the spawning grounds, the gills have a good chance of finding a willing male partner. The jacks, on the other hand, are either chased away by larger males, or they must wait for the opportunity to get a piece of the fertilization action in what is known as sneak mating. So why are Chinook getting smaller overall?
The sky's the limit right now on hypotheses for what is causing that. You've got climate change. You've got other competing hypotheses with stuff going on in the ocean. There's a term called late-stage mortality. So are these fish dying from predators, from lack of nutrients to get old, or is it that they're returning because they get sexually mature faster? So there's not a silver bullet yet on what is causing this, but it's not a phenomenon that's just local to the Kuskokwim.
Some point to factory trawler bycatch in the Bering Sea as a prime suspect, but a 2018 study published in the journal Fish and Fisheries suggested that a burgeoning population of northern resident killer whales may be targeting the larger fish in greater numbers. Whatever the case, smaller Chinook salmon and net restrictions aimed at selecting for these small fish mean that jacks, and the occasional gill, will likely remain a familiar sight on the Kuskokwim River. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547. Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailer to remove plants, animals, and mud. Drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
More than 100 cyclists took to the streets on Saturday for the second annual Critical Mass Ride for Anchorage event, where the crowd pedaled as a pack through Midtown. Marie Francis, one of the event's organizers, says the large group ride is a way to call attention to the need for cycling infrastructure in Anchorage.
It is perfectly legal for bikes to ride in the road, but there are a lot of really aggressive motorists that make it feel unsafe. And we think that if there was a protected bike lane, then there would be space for cyclists to get around.
The route followed Northern Lights Boulevard, where the crowd of cyclists occupied two of the four lanes of westbound traffic. It's a busy road with no bike lanes. Francis contends there should be room for a protected bike lane. Cyclists like Jedediah Smith say they don't feel comfortable riding on Northern Lights as it is. Smith, a commuter from Spinard, says he avoids it at all costs.
Yeah, I mean, Northern Lights is super scary. I never ride down Northern Lights, and I think probably one of the only ways I would do it would be in a big group like this. It would help me feel safe.
Cyclists wearing reflective vests blocked off intersections while the group passed through. Organizer Olivia Garrett says many motorists were excited about the mass ride.
And I think it just kind of points to the fact that Anchorage residents drive because they have to and not because they necessarily want to. And we found that a lot of the people in cars and the traffic that were along the route were very supportive, very respectful of our space, very enthusiastic.
The ride was a little over 3 miles, taken at a leisurely pace. People of all ages attended, from toddlers and bike trailers to the Anchorage Senior Center cycling group, the Silver Streakers. The route started and ended at the Lusac Library. On Tuesday, the Anchorage Assembly is taking public testimony on cycling and pedestrian infrastructure needs. Stones, hammers, and tree trunks hurled through the air in Homer recently at the annual Ketchikan Bay Highland Games, a chance for athletes from Alaska and beyond to show off their strength alongside Celtic musicians and local vendors. KBBI's Sabine Pooks visited the games and has this story.
Come on, guys, field record here.
Wearing a kilt speckled with ironed-on patches, Anchorage athlete Rob Moody picks up a large burlap cube using a pitchfork and faces a tall gate. Travis Ogden of Homer watches on.
So that's a burlap bag with hay and sometimes chain in it to make it heavy enough. And it's 16 pounds, and I think he's throwing it 33 feet, but I'm not sure. So this is, if he makes this, it's a field record.
Moody throws the bag, known as a sheaf, and narrowly misses the mark, getting the height right but not quite nailing the placement. Still, it's higher than anyone's thrown a sheaf today, which makes Moody the winner in his age category. Ogden and the other athletes hoot and holler for their teammate.
I think when this starts at the beginning of the event, none of us know each other's names, and probably two events in, we all know each other's names, and everybody cheers each other on. It's kind of nice.
The sheaf toss is one of the events in the annual Ketchikan Bay Highland Games, a celebration of Scottish culture and great feats of strength. There are games every year in Palmer and in Homer, where Renee Krause has been coordinating for 12 years.
We're really busy this year. There seems to be a lot more people coming through. and a lot more people from out of the area, too.
Krause attended Highland Games as a kid in Florida and today clerks Homer's Parks Commission, which is where the local games started in 2011. This year's event is in memory of her daughter, Rhiannon Winstead, who did the artwork for the organization and passed away fighting a battle with cancer last year. Today, the games in Homer bring up judges from Idaho and athletes from around the country.
We've got two athletes on the field that are from California. We had a runner for the Kilted 5K that was from Australia.
Krause says sometimes they'll get tourists who are vacationing in Homer and decide to sign up. The games also draw a wide range of spectators, like Kim Keck of Soldotna. He's watching from beneath a shady tree as athletes toss sheafs and cabers, or large tree trunks. And like many others, he's taken the chance to dress the theme, a combination of traditional Scottish and medieval garb.
I have what's called a modern kilt. This is the tartan of Clan MacNeil. My grandmother was a MacNeil and from the Isle of Barra. And so
Keck wears a purse around his waist and a dagger in his kilt band. On his feet are knee-high leather boots he bought at a Renaissance festival in his home state of Maryland.
It's a great chance to get outside, enjoy the beautiful weather, and have fun, and have some food, and listen to some music, and dress up in costume.
The Scottish Games have taken Anchorage's Rob Moody around the continent. He's the athlete who was trying to beat the sheaf toss record at the top.
I actually grew up down the street from where the big one used to be in Eagle River. So it started about the time I was born in the early 80s and kind of watched it as I was growing up new. One day I'm going to do this. I really want to do it.
He says it's easier on the body than other sports like powerlifting. And he says it's a lot of fun.
You finally find something that you're good at. You know what I mean? I just took to it like a duck to water, if you know what I mean.
Anchorage athlete Shahala Walsh is watching the heavyweight toss a few yards away. She's been coming to the games for 3 years. Her nickname is Giggles.
It was my yes year, and my boss asked me if I wanted to do this, and I said yes. And then I said, what is it? She said, I'll tell you after you sign up. And so I did, and then I found out. And I've been doing it ever since. It's super fun.
Gabriella Reinhardt of Anchorage started throwing in 2021.
So I used to do track and field in high school and college. And then I found out about the Highland Games. And so it was a lot of pressure, but I got through it. And now I love it. And so I tell anybody who can, do the Highland Games.
To those who are thinking about getting involved next year, she says, just do it.
We have a beautiful community. Like me, you know, African-American, I'm not Scottish. And I was welcomed immediately. So just open your mouth and say, hey, I want to try this. I want to do this. And we'll welcome you in.
And who knows, you might take to it like a duck to water, too. In Homer, I'm Sabine Pooks.
I couldn't sleep at all last night.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Francisco Martinez-Cuello and Evan Erickson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denny and Thomas Copeland in Petersburg, Yvonne Crumrie in Juneau, Dev Harker in Anchorage, and Sabine Pooks in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
And by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.